Welcome back to Broad Appeal. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
And this is the second part of Michelle Pfeiffer, The Bad. Now, it should be said, Sean, since this is the first episode of the new series, of course there are subjective categorizations. What's really bad? What's good? What's crazy? And some of the films, in fact, probably the majority that we've selected, are ones that we haven't seen before, but we kind of thought, okay, they seem like they're bad, or they seem like they're crazy. Yeah?
Yeah, so we have films chosen to watch.
And I suppose there's a possibility that something we think is bad, maybe one of us might think end up thinking is good. We'll see. Now, the Michelle Pfeiffer bad film that we're about to discuss, I was shocked to learn, has a 70% rating on Rotten Tomatoes and a rave review from 2002 from the New York Times. And I think there are some people out there, in fact, I know there are, who think this film is good. The film is called White Oleander, or as you like to refer to it,
Blonde the Movie.
He came into our lives without warning. She ignored him at first. He wasn't her type. We laughed about him, his persistence. Never let a man spend the night, she said. Never apologize, never explain. She was breaking all her rules, and it would change everything. What are you doing up here?
Come sit next to me. It's the best place to feel the wind.
I can feel it from here.
No, you can't.
Okay. You should get some sleep.
I never sleep. I've been up here for hours. I had the most amazing idea for how to use my Polaroids in the Newport show. I'm gonna skip work today. Keep going until I finish.
You're still coming to parents' night, aren't you?
Oh, God, I forgot.
Okay, this movie came out in 2002.
Yes, the cultural wasteland of cinema in the early 2000s. Post 9/11 until 2007-2008... is a cinematic wasteland.
I'm sure somewhere far flung, like in Thailand, a Pichapong where Satakun was making some good movies, or maybe in, I don't know,
Bosnia and Herzegovina.
There were probably some great movies coming out. But yeah, I think you're right. All you have to do is look at the Oscar lineups from those years, from A Beautiful Mind onward. I missed White Oleander when it came out. Just describe like how blonde the movie is. It has Michelle Pfeiffer,
Renee Zellweger, Alison Lohman, and Robin Wright.
Wait, who? No, honestly, Sean, who is Alison Lohman?
Well, Alison Lohman was in a film I quite like called Drag Me to Hell.
Is that a horror movie?
Yes.
Okay, great. But I mean, like, first of all, she gets top billing in this movie.
Well, she was a young starlet at the time.
But I'm saying she's a young starlet who, as far as I could tell, didn't star in anything else.
No, she starred in things around that time.
Like what?
I can't remember.
Okay? This is what I'm saying. They clearly were grooming her for a big star treatment because she is in almost every scene of this movie, right? Like it's a female Bildungsroman based on an Oprah book. Now, if an Oprah book club book is the sort of thing that makes your heart sink, then White Oleander is going to make it sink even further, like deeper than the deep end of the ocean, like deeper than Gloria Stewart dropping that, you know, necklace into the Atlantic.
Deeper than the core of starting Hilary Swank.
Okay, clearly we didn't like this film. We think it's bad. Come at us if you're a White Oleander apologist. But honestly, you're right. This film is so white. Like, can we enumerate all the ways in it's white? Like, the poster is white.
It's also, like, really bleached.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the cinematography is bleached. The poster is bleached. The women all have alabaster skin, blonde hair. Okay, so basically, I just read the Wikipedia plot description of the novel just to see how it compared. Anybody who was not white who appeared in the novel was taken out. So they're like Latina characters, black characters. None of them are in it. And instead we get this cavalcade of blonde on blonde. In its favor, it definitely passes the Bechdel test, yeah? I mean, come on. It's a very female-centered film. It's yeah. about a relationship between a mother and a daughter, and then yeah. the daughter's relationship with all these other women.
But what are women in films supposed to do to pass the Bechdel test?
Not talk about men.
Yeah.
But they don't always talk about men.
Okay, it passes in places, but this film is obsessed with blonde women talking about men.
Definitely, it sells out at the end because she sort of ends up with a boy, and that's kind of what saves her. But the fundamental toxic relationship at the heart of this movie is about a young woman realizing the influence that her mother has had on her and how she needs to, like, take herself out of the snares of her mother's relationship. Now, that mother is an artist named Ingrid, and her daughter's name is Astrid. They have some sort of Scandinavian roots because the mother is always saying things like, "We don't cry, we're Vikings, remember?" Okay, so the mother is played by our subject, Michelle Pfeiffer. I can kind of see, as she's sitting down with her agent, and her agent's like, "Michelle, baby, we got this, you know, Oprah book they're trying to pitch. It's going to be great." I can kind of see why she thought in 2002, as her career was kind of entering a slump,
now,
it was a
good role. Now, that's the important part, yes.
Yeah, go on.
We talked about the Fabulous Baker Boys in part one. And all through the 90s, you know, we talked about Batman Returns and obviously Love Field. She got an Oscar nomination for...
Not a good film.
Not a good film, but an Oscar nomination.
Sure, she was riding high.
Okay, she had One Fine Day, she had Dangerous Minds, all these kind of things that, for better or for worse, were, you know, starring vehicles.
And hits.
And hits. And come the early 2000s, she's probably reaching 40 or something, she suddenly becomes difficult.
You mean difficult to cast?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that can we enumerate the qualities of this character of Ingrid that would seem like a good one for her? She's a mother, true, but she's not like a dopey sort of boring mother. She's an artist.
Yeah, she gets to play someone in prison.
Yeah, so she becomes a killer. Like, basically, the plotline is she's a tempestuous, dangerous artist type, single mother, living in California, and she ends up being accused of murder of a man who's her lover, and then we follow her daughter, Alison Lohman, as she gets shunted off to several different foster parents and different juvenile institutions, and we keep returning to Michelle Pfeiffer as the mother, mostly in prison, right? So she's coming to visit her in prison, and they have these scene after scene of Michelle Pfeiffer in her kind of orange jumpsuit, you know, whispering, manipulative, gnomic pieces of advice to Alison Lohman, and like Alison Lohman like keeps being influenced by whoever the various foster mothers she's with. She sort of dresses like this one and dresses like that one, and then Michelle Pfeiffer is always like, "Those people are weak. You've got to not stick around troubled people. We're Vikings. We're Vikings." I guess what I'm saying is, like, a good version of this movie
on paper.
The role is interesting. Would you agree? Well, come on. Consider, like, the complexities of this character. Like, first of all, it begins... It has a score by Thomas Newman. So the opening credits come. The score begins. And instantaneously, I was like, I know this score.
This is the score from every goddamn trailer in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, the most famous thing about this movie, White Oleander, is this score by Thomas Newman, which has that sort of, like...
it's not the American Beauty one, but it's the other one.
It sounds like American Beauty... But I swear I've heard it, like, dozens and dozens of times in all sorts of trailers. It's this kind of twinkly, synthesized sound. Anyway, so that starts going. And then we're introduced to Astrid and Ingrid. I know it's based on a popular novel and it's an Oprah book, but there are just huge chunks of voiceover and text that's not delivered in voiceover, which just sounds like it's been cut and pasted from this novel.
Well, like, novelistic dialogue always sounds crap.
We're seeing Michelle Pfeiffer on the roof and her hair is blowing in the wind. Alison Lohman is saying things like, "My mother was the most beautiful person that anybody had ever seen. I know you always think that when you're small, but in this case, it's true." And, you know, we've already said that about Michelle Pfeiffer. She is the most beautiful woman that probably anyone's ever seen. And this character is dangerous. And at the start, the daughter is kind of enthralled to her mother. She's, like, absorbing all her mother's advice and stuff. But it's just, like, Oh my god. Like, Michelle Pfeiffer is saddled with saying the most dreadful lines. Like, things that you're just like, oh my god, if this were my parent, I would just want to stab their eyes out, you know? Like, she's showing her daughter her photographic collage of mugshots on the wall. And she's saying things like, what do you like? Do you like it? And she's like, yeah, it's really nice. She's like, you're not looking hard enough. How are you ever going to be an artist yourself if you don't learn to look at what's right in front of your face? I know I just praised Michelle Pfeiffer's line readings from The Fabulous Baker Boys and the way she makes those zingers feel witty and fun and sharp. I think if you were just to watch this film, you'd be like, what a wooden actress who is kind of over-enunciating things and kind of delivering in a very stilted way. Maybe there's no good way to deliver these lines. I'm not sure.
Well, that's the thing. She's not really in conversation with anyone in the film, is she? Even when she's talking to people, she's delivering these lines in this very, very stilted way that doesn't really stretch her abilities.
And I guess we're supposed to understand that she is actually a bad influence on her daughter because her daughter needs love, she needs attention, she needs a stable life, and here's her crazy artist mother who's sleeping with lots of different men and then murdering one of them. She's like that kind of mother who's like a straight talker and seems like she's relating to her daughter as if her daughter is an adult, but in a way that that's not what the child needs. No, in fact, what the child really needs is Renee Zellweger, and a like upper middle class income, but we'll get to that.
I am not a fan of this picture, and I feel that Michelle Pfeiffer's character doesn't even stand for anything. I said to you earlier that I think she's just this tidal wave of villainy. One, she doesn't seem like a very charismatic person. Two, she doesn't sound like a person. Her art is not very good. She's not motherly enough for us to believe that this girl, Alison Lohman, wants to be kind of reunited with her, or that there's some way to redeem her. This is a film of the early 2000s in the sense that it probably could have been something good, but it's an unmitigated pile of puke.
So you've avoided watching Viola Andrews all these years. Can we just enumerate, in a, like, beyond Michelle Pfeiffer's character, what are some of the other, like, crazy, laughable, or bad things? Like, the girl goes on this series of different homes that she lives in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very Dickensian kind of film, really, isn't it?
Well, I think it's like a would-be Dickensian, right? Yeah. Like Oliver Twist, like
episodic.
Nicholas Nickleby, yeah. Like
The Tin Drum.
Which you would... to Charles Dickens, right? The Tin Drum.
Well, it's very much like The Tin Drum, which you refuse to watch with me.
Well, I mean, in the sense that it's about through the eyes of a child, we see all these different strata of society and these different types. Like, she's with Robin Wright, and who's Robin Wright?
Okay, so Robin Wright is my favorite thing in the whole film.
Yeah?
Okay, Robin Wright is infinitely more interesting than the Michelle Pfeiffer character.
Okay.
No, she is, because you're wondering, what's her story?
Well, who is she?
So she plays Star. Now, Star is this born-again, oh my god, banging, the most banging body I think I've ever seen on a human.
It's true. I mean, like...
So I'm trying to describe the character, but I just am distracted by how amazingly sexy she is.
Yeah, there's a couple of shots where she's in just her bra and her panties, and, like, you even said, like, what was Sean Penn thinking about, like, treating this woman badly?
Yeah, so she plays Star, who's this born-again Christian woman who seems to adopt kids professionally.
Yeah.
And foster kids professionally. And she has the most smoking body you'll ever see on a person.
Okay, without objectifying the woman any further, do you think Robin Wright plays the role well?
She plays it very well because she's this kind of, like, dare I say, white trash type of trailer park realness.
Yeah.
She's very nice, but she says to the kids immediately, it's like, have you accepted Jesus in your heart?
As your personal savior?
As your personal savior. You know, she gets into little squabbles with the kids, especially the girls who are of menstrual age.
Basically, they're all lusting after her boyfriend, who's a hunky mechanic.
Called Ray.
Yeah, and when do we hear Ray's name the most?
Oh my god. So this is also just to add to how ludicrous this film is, okay? So the walls in this, you know, mobile home are made of, like, sugar paper. And so she chooses the middle of the day, I think it was, to have the loudest sex with Ray, in which she goes like, Ray, Ray, pound me, Ray.
But there are also, there's just all these convenient moments where Alice Loman is in one room and then
reading a book.
Reading a book or having a voiceover, you know, or reading a letter to her mother in prison. And like Robin Wright will just conveniently shout things from the other room like, I'm sick of having that girl in the house. We got to get rid of her. You're lusting after her, Ray. And like, but literally, it's okay to like use that device once, but I feel like it's literally used four times if we're like overhearing something from the other room. I mean, at least Robin Wright, I guess, adds a little bit of welcome zip and kind of humor to the film. But, you know, basically, that episode ends with a new trauma for the girl. So her mother has killed someone, and then she's been sent here, and then how does that...
I'm pretty sure that there's a murder-suicide or something.
Yeah, well, I have to say, like, the plotting of this film is very confused. It has the quality of a film that, in the edit, a lot of stuff was cut out, and they couldn't really make the strands, like, cohere, because... Yeah, well,
for example, Billy Connolly is, like, third billing in the film, and he hasn't got a single line.
So he plays the person that Michelle Pfeiffer kills and is accused of killing, but we kept saying, well, there's going to have to be a flashback to, like, the relationship between Billy Connolly and Michelle Pfeiffer, because it's Billy Connolly. They've cast, like, an actual name actor, but he literally could have just been an extra based on how he appears in the film, and there is no flashback, you know, explaining the murder. So anyway, Robin Wright shoots at Alison Lohman in, like, a fit of rage.
And she hits her.
Yeah. Alison Lohman then spends a bit of time in juvie.
Not before the paramedic played by Melissa McCarthy helps her.
Oh yeah,
her.
It shows up, that's right. And also Anna Kendrick appears in a brief cameo later, so there were quite a few people who would go on to become best supporting actress.
There were cameos nominees. In the sense that they were one scenes, but they weren't cameos in the sense they were stars.
No, they were unknowns. But yeah, so Melissa McCarthy pulls her out in the ambulance when she's got a gunshot wound. She ends up in juvie, and then, so she goes from being like a Christian when she's with Robin Wright, to then being in juvie and she becomes a tough girl. This is the only point where we have any non-white people appear. There are like, you know, random Latina girls who say things like, look, here comes the puta, and stuff like that. And then, oh my god, I said this to you when we were watching the movie, so she goes into the girl's bathroom, and what does she do to show that she's transforming herself?
She cuts her hair.
Honestly, people, has there ever been a good movie in which a girl stares in the mirror and cuts her hair?
It.
Yentl. Okay, there's two. But honestly, like, what a fucking tired trope. So then she has short hair and she's tough and she gets into fights and other things happen and she keeps going back and forth and meeting Michelle Pfeiffer, and Michelle Pfeiffer keeps saying other dreadful, terrible things to her.
Don't attach yourself to anyone who shows you the least bit of attention because you're lonely.
Which, to be honest, is a good bit of advice. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I read it on a greeting card, I'd be like, I agree. Although this is a very cynical greeting card.
Well, there is one piece of cynical greeting card philosophy that I did like, which is that a man will never call you when he's getting what he wants from somewhere else. Am I right, Brian?
You're absolutely right, Sean. I guess, I know you're saying that the mother is entirely bad, but what I'm saying is she speaks certain truths, like these ones that you've enumerated, but, like, that's not what a mother should be doing, right? So, actually, the person in the film, I think we're meant to believe, who comes closest to being a good mother is that much maligned actress who, to be honest, probably was at the ascendant right now. You were just pursing your lips, like you'd eaten a lemon.
I'm squinting my eyes.
So that person, of course, is Renee Zellweger. And this was the height of Zellweger mania, right? Like, she'd appeared in Jerry Maguire, she'd had Bridget Jones, she was gonna get her Oscar nominations for Chicago, and then eventually the inexplicable Cold Mountain win. So, and White Oleander's right in the middle. The movie gets even whiter, right? Because she goes to Renee Zellweger's Malibu house, which has entirely white decor. They're drinking white wine.
They eat boiled chicken breast.
And rice. I don't know if they do. But
no, but they definitely drink white wine.
Like it. It's also entirely furnished from, like, Crate and Barrel. It looks like a Crate and Barrel ad.
She is an actress on the descent of her career who loves a man. They spend plenty of time talking about the man as well. who is like a producer, director.
Her husband.
Yeah, her husband, yeah.
Noah Wyle.
Noah Wyle, who's a doctor in an emergency room somewhere.
No, he's a film director.
Okay. They adopted this foster child because they wanted to rekindle their marriage because of an affair that he had, blah, 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 blah. And once again, poor Astrid seems to be in a bedroom with a wide open door while two people basically say, let's get rid of the kid.
Well, and this is also not before, like, she really responds to Renee Zellweger.
Yeah, she...
Like, Renee Zellweger is actually winning in this film.
Yeah,
she's cute.
Lovely, yeah. And she's a good mother, and they do lots of things together. You know, she says to poor Astrid, you know, when were you happiest? And she says, this day.
She also, you know, she's going to be a good mother when the first day she's like, oh, here, I didn't want to decorate your room because I wanted to leave it blank for, like, you to decorate however which way you want. I could also get you a smoothie. And you're like, God, I want this person.
I mean, I didn't know what sodas you drink, so I just got Pepsi.
But of course, Michelle Pfeiffer's mother does not like this person at all because she starts to notice that...
Her daughter is dressing very frumpily.
Probably shopping at Pier 1 Imports.
She's wearing a...
Or J. Crew.
She's wearing a commitment ring around her neck.
So, you're an actress. So glamorous. Oh, no. My career is a disaster. Like, it's the process. It, you know, maybe too painful for
you're
me.
You're such a sensitive person. It's all that rejection. It's got to be hard on your self-esteem.
Typical Pisces. But that's why Astrid and I get on so well. And Scorpio and Pisces understand each other.
Oh. You're into astrology?
She's not into astrology just because she knows our signs.
Astrid and I used to understand each other. But she's become so secretive.
Astrid isn't secretive at all. No, we talk about everything all the time. We just love her. She's doing so well. She's on the honor roll. And we're just working to keep that old grade point average up.
Why don't you put a pyramid over her desk? They say it improves memory.
My memory's fine. Pyramid? I hadn't thought of that. I do practice feng shui, though.
Then it's, like, weirdly implied that through an epistolary conversation between Michelle Pfeiffer and Renee Zellweger, that somehow Michelle Pfeiffer is so clever in manipulating words and psychology that she basically induces Renee Zellweger to commit suicide. Which is a plot device that doesn't make any sense. Like, could you, like, get letters from Michelle Pfeiffer and then end up overdosing on sleeping pills in Chablis? Like, what's
written... Well, I mean, it's happened to me before by accident, but...
What's written in those letters? And then, like, Alison Ullman is like, you poisoned Billy Connolly and now you poison her, but this time it's with words.
I found this actually really distressing, this
part. What do you mean?
Because for one reason or another, she's sleeping in the same bed as Renee Zellweger. I think after
because they're close.
After she's
loving.
Been fingered.
That is not in there. It might have been in the original book.
But she wakes up with a dead body beside her of the foster mother whom she loves, that her mother in prison has driven to suicide in the same room as her.
And then yet again, like, the ambulances are called, and, like, also... In the movie, she's 15 when all of these misadventures begin. She becomes an adult when she's 18. So we're meant to believe that in 3 years, she's had three different foster families, plus a stint in a juvenile detention center.
Yeah, we haven't
and
mentioned
And they all
the...
end in, like, violence and tragedy.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned the Russian woman yet.
Yeah, because this comes after.
Yeah, well, let's skim through this part.
Yeah, this was... Not a name actress, it's just Svetlana somebody. So she picks her, and
She was a named actress, Brian, in Russia, perhaps.
I know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, don't be so Occidental, Brian.
Okay. She hangs out with this Russian lady who, like, basically seems to scavenge for things.
She seems to sell dirt to rubes at jacked up American prices.
This is the one bit of the movie that is not at all white. If you notice, like, her house is bathed in red and the woman wears, like, crazy colorful floral patterns.
Well, she has Soviet red hair.
Yeah. So this is where we finally move through to the, like, stunning climax where, you know, Michelle and Alison Lohman are going to finally air out all their grievances. And, like, here is where, as a writer, I just, like, what is going on with this story? Like, suddenly, for no reason, like, she's visited her mother dozens and dozens of times throughout the movie, and then suddenly she's like, can we just talk about when I was a girl and you, like, abandoned me with a neighbor woman and you left me and that left me traumatized, and she's like, why did you leave me? I was just a baby. And then Michelle's like, the real question is, why did I come back? And you're just like, none of this plot element has ever been touched on or discussed in the film. Why is it coming out now? So in this Wikipedia plot of the novel, I learned that this is like a repressed memory that the girl has had that comes out through an acid trip that she takes with one of the Russian lady's other foster daughters. I mean, none of that is depicted in the film. There's also, in the book, she lives with two other foster families, a suburban couple and a next-door neighbor who's a black prostitute, and then a Latina woman whose son is dying of AIDS.
Okay, also erased from the story.
Erased from the story. I mean, for good reason, because we didn't need more foster parents in this one film. That would literally be five different foster families.
Well, do you know why Oleander could work as a miniseries?
Oh, Big Little Lies too. I mean, maybe Michelle can get David E. Kelly to redo it. But
Big Little White Oleander.
Okay, there, can we just also say that perhaps the least commercial title ever in film is White Oleander. I don't even know what an oleander is.
It's
do you?
A poisonous plant, we've learned, didn't we?
Yeah, we learned that because they say it in the film. But
Blonde Oleander.
Did you know?
Honestly, it's like, you know, maybe we're just too woke in 2017 or something. But if I see a film that's full of all these blonde actresses, whether they're good or not, I think to myself, Jesus Christ, you know, this film is not exactly going to challenge the patriarchy, is it?
Can I say, so just, this is the most fascinating aspect of the book's plot. So, okay.
I know what this is.
We're waiting the entire time for, or at least I'm waiting for, like, the scene where we learn either Michelle Pfeiffer did or didn't kill Billy Connolly, and we're gonna, like, get Billy Connolly's big scene. It never comes. It's in this whole expositional monologue that she and Alison Lohman have. And then we kind of learn weirdly vaguely that she poisoned Billy Connolly, presumably with the oleander. None of it made any sense to me.
Do you know what I think happened? So we see her, like, we see her resting the oleander in milk. What she probably did was poison the milk and then made him drink it.
Well, okay, that may be because it's left, like, quite ambiguous in the film. But in the plot description of the Oprah Book Club book, this is what she does.
Okay.
I am reading verbatim from the Wikipedia page. It is revealed that Barry is cheating on Ingrid with younger women, leaving Ingrid shattered and enraged. Numerous attempts at reconciliation leave Ingrid increasingly humiliated and culminate with her breaking into Barry's house and spreading a mixture of DMSO, an arthritis drug, and oleander sap all over the surfaces of Barry's home. The DMSO allows the oleander poison to be absorbed into skin. As a result, Barry dies, and Ingrid is charged with his murder.
God.
What a stupid way to kill someone.
Or brilliant.
I know. Arthritis medicine mixed with a poisonous plant.
Do you think that would kill someone?
Well, I have no idea. I'm not a, you know,
toxicologist.
Thank you. Basically, let's just plow through the end of this. Like, well, so basically,
Brian, you're also missing that integral part of the book in which she's attacked by dogs and scarred for life.
Oh, yeah. She's apparently attacked by a dog and scarred for life. Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is, like, based on the Wikipedia plot, I can understand why they felt they had to change the book, but usually you want them to change it to make it better.
You know what I would like to have seen?
The Barbara Streisand version?
No, the Todd Solondz version.
Yeah, no, that would have been good.
It's very palindromes, this film, in some ways.
Interesting, interesting. We did learn that apparently Barbara Streisand was approached to both direct and star as Ingrid. The most beautiful woman anyone had ever seen. The wonderful Ingrid Shorenstein.
She's like, don't listen to these people, okay? They're nuts. They're nuts. I'm your mother, okay?
We don't cry. We're Hebrews. I could actually see it being a very Barbra Streisand movie. There's something about the, like, female psychology of it and the, like, working through therapeutic thing that does feel very Prince of Tides, but sadly, that movie was, you know, was not to be.
Yeah, it was cancelled when she found out that she couldn't cast Jason Gould in the role of Astrid.
Okay, just quickly, the ending. Basically, what happens is, you think the mother is going to be super manipulative and, like, force her daughter to, like, testify in court to save her, but actually what the mother does is not call Astrid to testify, and thus she lets her daughter go.
Also, do you notice that Michelle gets no scene of climax?
And that was actually one of the things that I liked about the movie. So they had this dreadful expositional thing where all this, like, boring bullshit backstory comes out, and then the daughter, like, you know, thinks she's going to be called in the courtroom. She doesn't get called in. And the last shot of Michelle is just her being walked out of the courtroom away, you know, to be taken, actually convicted and actually put into jail. And then Alison Lohman, like, ends up with a bland boy played by Patrick Fugit, and they go off and they live in a loft in New York, and she makes, like, even worse art than her mother made, which is, like, suitcases that are full of, like, trinkets, you know. And I'm just thinking, they're being like, Joseph Cornell did this decades before, baby, like, you know, it's not even original.
When the film started, for some reason I thought she said that she was planning to burn all the suitcases. So when the film was ending, I was like to Brian, I was like, wait, didn't she say she was going to burn these? Which seemed like the appropriate thing to do.
Sean likes for every movie to end as a towering inferno. Yeah. Okay, basically, is there any reason anyone should watch White Oleander?
If you're a Renee Zellweger completist.
would it fit somewhere into your syllabus that you're always talking about the nadir
of the cinema of repugnance?
would White Oleander have a prime slot?
I don't know, actually, but we can keep that as a sidebar as this series progresses.
Because this is about Michelle Pfeiffer, did watching this bad performance reveal anything about Michelle Pfeiffer? I will say there's one Susie Diamond moment, one line that she says where I saw the flash of 1989 Michelle Pfeiffer, where they're asking her what prison's like, and she says, yeah, I don't get much time to work on my art. I spend so much time fending off sexual advances, I can hardly think. So, you know, she's still got the flinty stuff in her.
She does.
I do think this played to all her kind of worst qualities.
I don't think it played to her worst qualities. I think it played to her most limited qualities.
It's bad material that, sadly, she can't do much with.
Yeah, and the thing is, at a certain point in your career, when you get a role like this, you can see people in the biz being like, White Oleander, I mean, she wasn't any good in it, was she, you know?
I mean, but it may be also that, as you say, Hollywood was in a fallow period, and frankly, I think one of the things that we're experiencing now, in 2016, 2017, is a lot of these older actresses who were brilliant in the 90s and the 80s, thankfully, and maybe partially through the rise of television, they're getting meatier, more exciting roles. Have you noticed that, like, the last several years, the best actress category is really packed with really strong roles, exciting roles for women, and a lot of them, more than in the past, are women over 40. So, you know, I think Michelle, she sort of disappeared from our screens for a long time around the time of White Oleander, you know, with occasional reappearances and pretty dreadful things. And I think we can just keep our fingers crossed that she gets more exciting material that can allow her to move into a whole new phase of her career, yeah?
Oscar nomination.
Yeah, we'll just leave White Oleander in the dustbin of history.
Yeah.
There's still one more film in our three-part Michelle Pfeiffer extravaganza. It is a crazy film, and it's going to take us all the way back to the beginning of Michelle's career. Stay tuned, and it'll be next up in the feed. If you're interested to find out what it is, what should they do, Sean?
Yeah, come and check us out on @BroadAppealPod. We might be giving some clues.
And we shall see you very, very soon to finish off Michelle Pfeiffer, the crazy.